And here's some good news for those of us who live for that morning coffee, Steve. All right, also green tea. A new study of 82,000 men and women in Japan, published in the medical journal Stroke, found that those who are in the habit of drinking green tea or coffee were significantly less likely to have a stroke. NPR's Allison Aubrey has more.
The striking thing about this new study investigating coffee and tea consumption is not that researchers found an association with less heart disease. It's the extent to which the habits seem to protect people. Let's start with green tea. Physician Ralph Sacco, the past president of the American Heart Association, says in this study, the more green tea a person drank, the more it reduced the risk of suffering a stroke.
It's almost a 20% lower risk of stroke in the green tea drinkers
who drank 4 cups a day compared to those who rarely drank green tea. And with coffee, researchers found just 1 cup per day was also associated with about a 20% decreased risk of stroke within the next decade.
It's a pretty important large effect. It is a large study, so the larger the study, the more you're able to detect effects like this.
Now, Sacco says it's not just the Japanese who seem to benefit. Over the last few years, researchers in the U.S. have documented similar reductions in heart disease risk among Americans.
The more accumulating evidence from a variety of studies is suggesting that green tea and coffee may be protective.
Studies suggest a coffee habit may also cut the risk of Parkinson's and type 2 diabetes. Now, it's interesting to note that not long ago, there was completely different thinking about coffee. In the 1980s, many Americans were trying to avoid it. Caffeine was thought to be harmful, even at moderate doses. Harvard's Mayor Stanford says one reason for this is back then, coffee drinkers also tended to be heavy smokers. And in early studies, it was really tough to disentangle the two habits.
So it made coffee look bad in terms of health outcomes.
As newer studies began to separate out the effects of coffee and tea, a new picture emerged, one suggesting benefits, not risks. Now, the Heart Association's Ralph Sacco says there's still a lot to learn here. Researchers haven't nailed down all the mechanisms by which coffee and tea influence our health, and he says when it comes to preventing strokes and heart attacks, no one food or drink is a magic bullet. It's our overall patterns of eating and exercise that are important.
It's really a whole lifestyle approach, and we need to remember that.
So if you're already in the habit of drinking coffee or green tea, this study is one more bit of evidence that you should go ahead and enjoy it. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News, made possible by this cup of coffee. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inske.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. You know, American winemaking has come of age, not just in Napa, Walla Walla, and the Willamette Valley, but in places that are probably less familiar as wine regions. Ohio, Texas, Hawaii, and Alaska. There are more than 7,000 American wineries operating today. That's up from just about 400 back in the 1970s. Jancis Robinson is a leading authority on wine. She traces what she calls an American wine revolution in her new book, American Wine, the Ultimate Companion to the Wines and Wineries of the United States. Jancis joins us from Melbourne, Australia. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
So we are the leading group of wine guzzlers in the world now?
Yes, it's quite amazing, isn't it? When you think that it was only as recently as the 1990s when the American wine industry was going on about neo-prohibitionists and they were feeling under threat. But now wine seems to be such a popular interest with a whole load of people, particularly young people, actually.
Americans certainly know about wine in California, Oregon, and Washington State. But I want to get you to talk about some other regions, maybe how good that wine can be is might be familiar to the locals, but not people across the country.
Yes, I think there is a tendency, isn't there, to reckon that your local wine can't be any good and that imported wine is somehow superior. But I don't think that's by any means always the case. Mm. I'm a huge fan, for instance, of some of the wines produced around the Finger Lakes in New York State, which has a long tradition of vine growing and is particularly good, in my view, at making lovely Rieslings, particularly the dry ones, very steely and noble, and they can age very well, which is a sign of great quality in a wine. I came across a really good copy of Champagne in somewhere where you'd least expect it, in New Mexico. Also, as one sort of looking at things historically, you might expect the state of Virginia, I think, is now making better and better wines, including some really, really smart Viogniers and Petit Monsengs, and some particularly fine Bordeaux blends.
Mm-hmm. And there are new urban wine-producing regions too, I gather.
That's fun, isn't it? I would say it's happening in America far more than anywhere else, that the interest in wine is being capitalised upon by people starting wineries right in the middle of cities, which, of course, is perfectly possible, that you just ship in the grapes from a nearby vineyard, and you can show people who are living in a city even how wine is made and take them on winery tours and, of course, sell direct from your winery.
So what do you say to people that would say, look, all of these wines are very interesting, but when the crunch comes, France and Italy?
Well, I would say that pretty much all countries that make wine make some good wine and some bad wine. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's true that the majority of the very, very, very finest wines I've ever had have been from France. But then France makes more wine than anyone else most years. I've had some stunning American wines. And I don't think anyone should think that American wine is necessarily inferior to, say, French or Italian.
Could you leave us with one or two of your most surprising finds? and make part of the surprise being the fact that we might be able to afford them?
Oh, sure. Well, there's been recently, because, of course, the interior of the US is very continental in climate and winters can be pretty harsh, which makes them quite tricky for these European vinifera vines. So there have been some new breeding of new varieties, particularly designed for very cold winters. And one of the more successful is called Traminette. It's a very sort of fruit, makes very fruity white wine. And another grape that I'm very keen on is All American. It was discovered in Virginia by a doctor called Norton. So it's called Norton. And it makes some really serious red wines, not just in Virginia, but quite widely, particularly in Missouri. So you can have a very respectable Missouri Norton that has not an ounce of influence of France or Italy in it.
Jancis Robinson, her new book, co-authored with Linda Murphy, is called American Wine, the Ultimate Companion to the Wines and Wineries of the United States. Jancis, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Coming up this St. Patrick's Day, a wrap-up of music from South by Southwest and why manipulated photography isn't new. But first, it is St. Patrick's Day, and chances are right now someone is singing Danny Boy and hoisting a pint. Americans love their beer. It's the world's most popular drink. But most of us know even less about the beer industry today than we do about how St. Patrick chased the snakes out of Ireland. So, belly up.
Refreshingly smooth, Bud Light.
Coors Light. It's Miller time.
Heineken. Sounds good.
That's our cover story, Big, Big Beer, and the sudsy fight to be America's draft. Beer. We drink enough fermented hops to consume more than $200 billion annually, and that's just here in the U.S. What you should know as you sip is that 90% of our domestic beer market is dominated by just two companies, Anheuser-Busch InBev and Miller Coors. But smaller brewmeisters are challenging that dominance. Craft beer, that is, smaller mom-and-pop-style breweries or regional breweries, now account for about 6% of domestic beer sales. Now, that might seem like a small number, but it's been growing every year since the early 1990s, while the big brewer share is declining. So let's begin by raising a glass at Meridian Pint, a trendy joint here in D.C., where you'd get run out of town if you tried to order a Coors. Brian Davis is a graduate student, and he's drinking a Nugget Nectar.
Really intense flavor. You know that you're supporting organizations that you care about, local economies.
You'll have a lot of choices in the future, too, now that there are more small breweries than there were before Prohibition, when beer was largely a regional business. And if you're really into beer, you can become a certified Cicerone. That's like a sommelier, only for beer. Sam Fritz is a Cicerone.
I try to have a nice mix of approachable craft beers as well as exciting new stuff for people who have tried a lot of the more everyday beers.
Sam Fricks is also the beer director for Meridian Pint, which also offers DC Brow, Flying Dog, and Oxbow Space Cowboy. He prides himself on offering this kind of hand-picked selection.
I do not carry any beers that come under the Miller or Coors or Bud labels.
That's just fine with his customers. Beer drinker Landon Wardham says he's not looking for those big names.
When I go out to a bar, I'm almost always looking for what haven't I tried before.
Last month, the Justice Department blocked an attempted merger between Anheuser-Busch InBev and the Mexican beer maker Grupo Modelo. Anheuser already owns 50% of the Mexican beer maker. Journalist Elizabeth Flock wrote about this and other trends recently in the beer market in U.S. News and World Report.
The Department of Justice has said that this merger would get rid of their competition. Anheuser-Busch is the biggest beer company in the world. MillerCoors is second, and Grupo Modelo is third. So if they were to buy Grupo Modelo, they would effectively get rid of their biggest competition that they could possibly own.
So, Elizabeth Flock, you've written that the market shares of the great big companies, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, is actually declining. Mm-hmm. What would a merger like that mean for the little craft breweries that we see? And how much of the market do they have?
So big beer, when I say big beer, I mean Anheuser-Busch, InBev, and MillerCoors currently have 90% of the market. And craft beer in the U.S. has 6%. And craft beer has said, even though they're new, they've only really been around since the 90s, that 6% is too small, 90% is too big, and that big beer is increasingly trying to keep craft beer down, and that this merger would just be sort of another step for big beer to be able to keep craft beer out, keep independent beers off the shelves away from consumers.
And how are we defining a craft beer?
Big beer likes to say that craft beer is just a marketing term. Craft brewers, on the other hand, would contend that craft beers are small, independent, family-owned, and they say that craft beer cannot be more than 25% owned by a big beer company, and that it also cannot make more than 6 million barrels of beer a year.
Maybe just to compare, tell me how big the corporate beer makers, the big beer makers actually are.
So I know that Anheuser-Busch, with just 14 of their 200 brands, gets $1 billion a year in revenue. And so, you know, when you have 200 brands, that effectively can take over store shelves.
That's another area where these brewers compete, isn't it? Just on the shelf space.
Absolutely. I would say that this is the number one place where this battle between craft beer and big beer is sort of playing out, because everyone wants to be in grocery store shelves at eye level. When a consumer goes and is just sort of scanning, they want to be there. And craft brewers say that big beer is increasingly pushing them out of those prime spots at grocery stores, at bars, at sporting arenas, at airports. Anywhere you can find a beer, they say they're increasingly being pushed out.
So there's a couple of craft beers that you cite as being owned by huge companies. You call these crafty beers. What do you mean by that?
The Brewers Association, it's sort of a term that they use to knock big beer for calling it crafty beer. And, you know, one of the things that they're most upset about, the sort of deceptive tactics that they say big beer is using, is to present beers that they make, that Anheuser-Busch or MillerCoors make, as craft when they aren't. So a really good example of this is Blue Moon. Blue Moon is an enormously popular beer. You can find it anywhere. A lot of people think that it's a craft beer, but in fact is made by MillerCoors.
So Blue Moon, now owned by MillerCoors, how do they advertise? Do they switch their advertising for something like the crafty beer?
You increasingly see big beer companies trying to advertise to the kind of person, a hipster type, or someone who's really into, you know, sort of a distinctive beer.
In a borough that has it all, we've come to Park Slope, where there's culture around almost every corner. Today, in a converted garage turned rock club, we're parked for a burger, a beer, and to get to know a great band. Check it out on The Local Scene, presented by Blue Moon.
In terms of the market, does it matter? Are these small beers, the craft beers, are they really getting squeezed out?
What craft brewers would say to that is they would say what matters is that consumers aren't getting choice. So they might go to a bar and there might be eight beers on tap. And you might see that one is, you know, Bud Light and one is a so-called craft beer and then one is an import beer. It seems like there are eight different beers. But in fact, all of those beers could be made by Anheuser-Busch. So does it matter? Maybe not. Maybe you like all of those beers and you feel like you're getting a variety. But in fact, you're only getting a variety from one beer maker.
And also, the craft brewing trade, as it has blossomed from, I think your article said that at one time there were maybe just a couple hundred individual beer makers, but now there's more than a couple thousand.
That's right, yeah.
This has obviously created a lot of jobs, a lot of vitality in different parts of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Although Big Beer would say that they create infinitely more jobs. And so to try to tamp down what they're doing would be to hurt the American economy, would get rid of jobs, and that craft beer just doesn't employ nearly as much.
Elizabeth Flock has reported on the beer industry for U.S. News and World Report. Crafty beer, though, might really be helping craft beer, says a 30-year veteran of the business. Benj Steinman is an editor for Beer Marketers Insights, a trade publication. The beers he's talking about are Blue Moon and Shock Top.
Some might say, well, what Anheuser-Busch and MillerCoors have done through Shock Top and Blue Moon is opened up a greater number of consumers to the universe of craft beers and their innovation, flavor, and variety. And they don't necessarily, you know, they're sort of gateway beers.
Gateway, meaning it's a more accessible craft beer. It might get you to start wanting to taste other things with notes of dark cherry or sassafras molasses. Julia Herz is the craft beer program director for the Brewers Association. She says big beer should print its names right on all its bottles.
What we've called for is a transparency of parent company ownership and to put that on the beer label so the beer lover has a chance to know who's behind those brands.
Herz says that branding matters to a lot of younger beer drinkers who are actually quite careful readers.
Many people care about the brands of what they consume and who owns those companies. And especially a lot of millennials are, you know, associating themselves with what they consume and what they hold in their hand.
Craft beers are without question, though, more expensive, which might make it harder for them to compete against the bigger brands.
This is a very middle class beverage. Working class beverage. So what a lot of people are looking for is what's affordable.
That's Chris Thorne. He's a spokesman for the Beer Institute, the largest beer industry trade group. He says that fierce competition is nothing new in this business. It's an American tradition.
When you look at the names of some of these breweries that we have today, whether it's Frederick Miller, whether it's Freddie Heineken waiting with off the shores of New York for Prohibition to end and come in, whether it's Adolph Coors, whether it's August Busch, these are names that are rooted in our heritage in the beer drinking culture in the United States, and they never got a break. They competed with each other.
And back at Meridian Pint, beer director Sam Fritz shows off his 24 beer taps, two dozen high-end brands, and he really doesn't want to lose his market share to beers pretending to be microbrews.
It certainly is more expensive. For what we're trying to do, we're trying to offer the highest quality products that we can, and that means buying from producers who use good ingredients and are innovative brewers.
But at the end of the day in the bar room, Landon Rorden says that even if he sampled some upscale microbrews at $6, $7, $8 a pint, he might go back down the ladder.
After I've had like three or four microbrews, I'll think, wow, that was $25, $30. I should probably get a Bud Light now because this is getting ridiculous, you know.
Then again, beer is for all occasions. Chances are that today, a lot of people are drinking green beer without much taste and enjoying every emerald drop.
Beer, 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 chimney beer, beer, beer.
A long time ago, way back in history, when all there was to drink was nothing but cups of tea, along came a man by the name of Charlie Mott, and he invented a wonderful drink and he made it out of hops.
Coming up, dating without beer goggles for people of a certain age, and NPR Music's Bob Boylan fills us in on the South by Southwest Music Festival. Stick around.
The Fury's bar, the Tansy's pub, the hole in the wall as well. Oh, one thing you can be sure of, it's Charlie.
This is NPR News.
they say it's 5 p.m. somewhere, so let's spend some time contemplating cocktails.
Pretty darn far east of here, but anyway, that's fine. In particular, the plants, flowers, vegetables, and seeds that your favorite libations are made of. Barley, by the way, becomes scotch. Rice becomes sake. Sugarcane is rum.
And distillers don't stop there. They add things like elderflowers, jasmine, or juniper berries to craft a more complex taste. Amy Stewart has written about wicked plants and wicked bugs. Her latest book is The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. Good morning.
Good morning.
You write in this book about going into a liquor store and having a vision of a garden in the bottles. Everywhere you turn, you don't just see the drink, but you see the grains, fruits, and flowers that have disappeared into it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I was with some friends. We actually went out to a liquor store to get some ingredients for this drink I wanted to make for them. And throughout the whole day, because I was with a bunch of gardeners, I was talking about, you know, we as gardeners should be more interested in this stuff. I mean, look at a bottle of gin. There's nothing in that bottle that isn't a plant. And the evening wears on, and I finally said, somebody ought to write a book about this. And all my friends said, yeah, why don't you do it? You're the one who can't shut up about it.
It does sound like a perfect conversation to have when you've had a couple, actually.
Right.
Give us an example of one drink. You know, I like Manhattans. One drink and what it's made up of.
Well, I like Manhattans, too, and I'm glad to know that you're a Manhattan drinker. We have that in common. And I think, actually, that's a great example. Manhattan easily has 20 or 30 plants in it. So you can start with the whiskey, which would contain barley, rye, and wheat or corn. And, of course, it's been soaked in an oak barrel, so let's not forget that that's another plant, the oak tree, that has a huge role in cocktails. And then you add sweet vermouth, which is a wine base, so there's your grapes. And then vermouth has a lot of spices and herbs. And then you splash on some Angostura bitters, and Angostura bitters have, oddly enough, not Angostura bark, but has a lot of other roots and seeds. And the final ingredient in a Manhattan is, of course, a cherry. And so there's one more plant.
Wait, tell us what plant turns up in more drinks than any other.
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's hard to figure that out. So here's my theory on this. I think that barley is very, very common because barley is in almost every kind of grain spirit around the world. And that forms the basis for not just beer and vodka and whiskey, but a lot of other liqueurs might have a grain base. But a really intriguing plant that I kind of fell in love with as I was writing this book is sorghum. Sorghum is a grain that we don't think about a lot. It's actually the fourth largest crop grown in the United States, and it's grown across Africa and used to make this homemade beer, this cloudy, opaque beer. And it's also grown across Asia, and particularly in China, where it's used to make Maotai, which is a very strong, clear spirit that is a traditional part of Chinese banquets. So I think that sorghum might actually be the plant that turns up in more alcohol around the world than any other, believe it or not.
You have a section of the book that you title Bugs in Booze. In this particular case, you're talking about earthworms.
You know, anytime you're talking about plants, bugs are not far away, right? So I kept reading reviews of scotch where they would talk about the worm flavor. And I thought, what are they talking about? Well, it turns out that it's a distilling term. As the spirit is coming out of the still, it goes through this particular kind of cooling and condensation process in this curly piece of copper tubing that they call a worm. And so scotch connoisseurs believe that they can taste the difference when that particular piece of equipment is used to make the scotch, and they call that a worm flavor. But no earthworms were harmed in the making of the scotch, I can assure you of that.
Many a college student is quite familiar with a particular use of a worm in spirits that you are very down on, and that's the gusano that's at the bottom of a bottle of mezcal or sometimes tequila. Bad idea, right?
Well, yeah, bad idea. So it's not found in tequila. By law, if you're going to put the word tequila on the label, you can't have anything in the bottle except tequila. So it's found in mezcal, and it's the larva of a pest that attacks the agave plant. But it's a gimmick. There are people in Mexico making really extraordinarily fine artisanal mezcals who would really like to see that banned because they think it reflects badly on the whole category.
Well, just a last question. If one is looking to do an unusual garnish or something particularly delicious, what might you suggest?
There is this amazing little cucumber relative. It's called Mexican sour gherkin cucumber. It's not technically a cucumber, but it's very closely related. The fruits are the size of a grape, and they're green with little white markings. So they actually look like miniature watermelons. And they taste great. They're sort of a little more tart than a regular cucumber, but they just look extraordinary. And the vines happen to be very prolific. So you do not have to be a very good gardener to be able to grow Mexican sour gherkin cucumbers.
Amy Stewart's latest book is called The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.